Good morning. The next case on our calendar today is A20-1068, Jody D. Campbell versus John J. Larson. This case is being heard on the Zoom platform today. The same procedural rules apply to this Zoom oral argument as apply to our regular in-person oral arguments. Each party will have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. As you can see, there's a clock showing the amount of time you have left in your argument in one of the rectangles in the grid view. And if we have any technological difficulties, the marshal will stop the clock to make sure you get your full allotment of time. Also a reminder that there is this oral argument is being recorded by the Court of Appeals today, and any other recordings are not permitted except with the express prior permission of the Court of Appeals. I'll ask counsel to please introduce yourself at the beginning of your argument and the party that you represent. And counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Mark Olson, O-L-S-O-N, and I represent the appellant John Larson in this matter. May it please the court and counsel, this is an appeal from an attorney fee award in a partition action. Statutory construction is a question of law that requires a de novo review by this court. The object of all interpretation and construction of laws is to ascertain and effectuate the intention of the legislature. If a statute is unambiguous, the reviewing court is to apply its plain meaning. Attorney's fees are not recoverable in litigation unless there's a specific contract permitting them or statute authorizing such recovery. When a statute does not specifically allow attorney's fees, you will not be construed to allow them. Partition statutes
have been around. Mr. Olson, I just want to ask a question here at the outset. Sure. Is this court required to dig into the text of the statute, given that there are decisions interpreting the statute already that have concluded that attorney fees are permissible in partition actions?
I believe it is, Your Honor, for a number of reasons. First of all, there's never been a constitutional challenge, which in this case is an applied challenge to the statute. Secondly, the Kohler decision cited by the court, it was incorrectly cited by the trial court. I think the statute needs to be looked at in conjunction with the Kohler decision. Furthermore, the Kohler decision was 60 years ago. There was not an award of actual attorney's fees in that case. It just set forth had long ago been recognized as a potential basis to award attorney's fees under the statute in the Hansen case. Since 1960, there have been a number of cases in Minnesota that I believe have altered the decision in Kohler, even though we believe the Kohler case supports our position that attorney's fees should not have been awarded. For instance, there have been cases interpreting what is meant by costs when costs are referenced in a statute. I believe that's the Anderson Medtronix case. There have been repeated determinations. Strike that. So yeah, I think we do have to go back and take a look at the actual wording of the statute, because we are so far down the road and because of the manner in which the trial court applied color to the facts of this case. Not sure if that answers your question.
So it sounds to me like you're essentially arguing that color is no not good law any longer, and then you have your secondary constitutional argument that the district court didn't consider.
Well, actually, we're arguing if, in fact, color is good law, it does not support the award of attorney's fees in this particular case. The trial court made a mistake. It cited color for the wrong proposition. Trial court cited color and stated that there was a title contest in color. And therefore, where there is a title contest, and an adversarial proceeding, attorney's fees aren't permissible. Well, there was no title contest in Culler. The fact of the matter is the Culler case specifically stood for the proposition that it does not therefore appear to be fair and equitable to allow attorney's fees in good faith adversarial partition cases. Here, there was no satisfactory showing of a benefit to all parties concerned, and the proceedings are regarded as adversarial in character. Under those circumstances, the statute, as interpreted in Hansen, does not appear to permit the allowance of attorney's fees. So in other words, the Culler decision did away with the condition that there be a title contest if, in fact, that actually was the case. Hard to know because there are no published decisions there are no published decisions I'm aware of where attorney's fees have been awarded under the partition statute. Cases cited, such as Hansen, there was no award in that case. It was a conceptual decision that fees might be awarded under these circumstances. The same with Culler. Culler merely cited Hansen and said, well, you know, there are certain circumstances where cases have recognized a right to pursue attorney's fees. But bottom line is the trial court made a mistake in its reliance on Culler because it misread Culler. The trial court also made a number of factual errors in...
Mr. Olson, yes. Just before you go on to your argument about factual errors with regard to Culler, I agree with you that Culler didn't involve a title contest, but and so in that regard, maybe the district court wasn't focusing on the proper language in Culler, but Culler does state that in partition proceedings where the final result is of benefit to all parties, a trial court in its discretion may award attorney's fees to plaintiffs.
Correct.
And would you agree that that language in Culler is applicable, is still good law?
Well, I guess it depends upon your reading of Culler, because Culler didn't say what that benefit had to entail. You know, could it be a 1% benefit that allows an award of $45,000 in attorney's fees? I don't think that was the intention of Culler at all. There are other circumstances under which attorney's fees have been awarded, even though a statute has not specifically allowed them. And in particular, there's the substantial benefit concept that appears in derivative stock actions and trust cases and whatnot. And it requires a substantial benefit to a party, not just some sort of benefit or some de minimis benefit. It has to be substantial in nature. I would submit under the facts of this particular case, my client didn't want the money. He wanted the property. And that's what he fought for from the beginning of the case till the end of the case. And he didn't get that. So he didn't get the benefit of what he was seeking. Money was not the goal for him. So it was not a benefit that he was seeking to obtain. So
it seems again, Mr. Olson, yes. that just sort of following up on Judge Cochran's question, in addition to the question and color about whether a party has received a benefit, the other sort of prong of the inquiry in determining the availability of attorney fees is whether the partition action was made in good faith or taken in good faith. Are you alleging that the partition action here was not a good faith partition action in some way?
We actually are. And that's why we it took so much time in our brief to develop the factual history of this matter. Clearly, the respondent had no reason not to allow my client to purchase property. He offered back in September of 2019, 4 or 5 months before trial, buy the property at a dollar amount. It was actually higher than what was ultimately sold for. my client offered $5,000 in liquidated damages in the event he was unable to close in February of 2020. That was turned down and rejected by the respondent. So no, we don't believe that she acted in good faith at all. She was acting in spite. She didn't want my client to have the property. So it wasn't a good faith action on her part. We have no doubt that she wanted money. She just didn't want the money from my client. It was anybody but my client that she wanted the money from. So I think there is a question whether or not there was good faith on the respondent's part in litigating this matter, because it could have been taken care of at the very outset of the case when my client actually understood what was going on, which wasn't until September of 2019. So I do question whether or not it was in good faith, yes.
It seems to me that district court concluded otherwise, that that this wasn't a bad faith action. And what are we to make of the district court's conclusions? How are we to treat the district court's findings about the intentions of the parties here?
I don't think you need to get to that particular issue, because the if you read the Culler decision, there seems to be a number of steps that have to be gone through in order to seek the attorney's fees. One of them is a good faith basis for bringing the action itself. Okay, let's assume for argument's sake that there was a good faith basis to bring the action. You still don't get over the adversarial nature, extreme adversarial nature of the contest in question here. I mentioned the substantial benefit rule. There are also discussions. I think there was a Belleville case back in 1944, 45, involving an estate. And you had to look at the actual, in order to get to employing equitable relief, you had to make certain demonstrations. And again, it wasn't just a some sort of relief that could be granted or some sort of benefit that was granted, which again, we concede there was a benefit to my client. It just simply was not the benefit he was seeking. And it was not a substantial benefit.
I want to follow up on the comment that you made about how this was an adversarial proceeding. And of course, that's something that was identified in the Culler decision. What is adversarial? Isn't every partition action necessarily adversarial? What's your interpretation of that term as used by the Culler court?
You know, I looked at the definition in Black's for adversarial. And it seems to cover a panoply of different situations and circumstances. To me, adversarial in this particular context means it's more than just simply a lawsuit. It's you know, you're going to have in a lawsuit, you're going to have differing opinions on both sides, and that makes it adversarial in nature. Arguably, based on the Culler decision, though, any partition action where the parties aren't lockstep with regard to the ultimate result could be deemed to be adversarial, and likely is adversarial. I guess there are different degrees of what an adversarial proceeding is, though. And in this particular case, the trial court recognized from the very get-go that it was an adversarial contested matter. So I'm not so sure that affects it either, because there are partition actions where one party might bring a partition action and the other people who stand to benefit from it don't participate. That's not an adversarial partition action. This was an adversarial partition action. I don't know if that answers your question. Okay. About a minute and a half here. So I'm going to just briefly talk about the constitutional challenge as applied in this case. As I indicated, there has never been a challenge to the statute or a chapter 558 in general. In particular, two things happened here. The trial court indicated that it was treating my client differently because allegedly there was no title contest involved. And it's our position that that's a violation of the Equal Protection Clause because there isn't any real difference between somebody in a title contest and where there isn't a title contest. The goal or the outcome is always the same.
Did you raise your equal protection argument in the district court?
We did. And we disagreed with the court's handling of that matter. I would note that under the law, we didn't have to in order to have this court review it. But we addressed it in our memorandum that was timely submitted. It was near the end of the memorandum. I think there was about a page and a half that addressed the separation of powers, equal protection arguments. And they were, in fact, timely. What the trial court was referring to in its decision was, we served a copy of the pleading itself on the Attorney General's office following day, which we believe is timely under the statute. And I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
I'll try again. Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Rod Cheetah, and I represent the respondent Jody Campbell in this matter. If I just might begin briefly with the constitutional argument made by appellant, we would argue first that, of course, his Rule 5A notice under the Rules of Civil Procedure was tardy, having come a day after its final submissions were due in the case. But assuming an as-applied challenge is not subject to that rule of notice, if we look at the trial court's April 10th order for submissions on attorney's fees, the court clearly stated that submissions were due on April 13th and April 27th, and that no reply will be permitted. And that should have signaled to appellant that at the very latest, between April 10th and April 13th, the appellant would have been required to give notice of his constitutional claim to respondent so that she could have also briefed the issue to the district court, or one of the parties could have asked for an extension. But appellant having not done that, of course, respondent submitted her trial court brief without any constitutional argument. And so aside from whether there's a strict notice requirement to the attorney general, this is a situation where the district court was faced with arguments for the first time in a post-trial brief. And so the arguments there are not properly before the appellate court pursuant to the Ware decision versus Buffalo Red River Watershed case from this court in 2001, published case, of course. With respect to the attorney's fees issues, appellant really had, you know, two arguments to make on this front. One of them would have been that, you know, the fees were objectionable in scope or amount somewhere, but appellant failed to do that in his April 27th memorandum to the trial court, and coincidentally claimed that his own fees were $43,000, nearly an identical amount to plaintiff's fees or respondent's fees. And he failed to do this again on appeal to argue that the amounts or the scope of the fee was somehow improper. And so that left him with one argument, and that is to argue that the determination of the attorney's fees was an abuse of discretion. But as we can see from color, even the factual determinations by the court are decided under a abuse of discretion standard. That's right in the color decision. And so this is an extremely high burden, especially when dealing with a partial award. Of course, Mr. Larson paid half of his fees and, Ms. Campbell paid half of her fees and Mr. Larson paid the other half.
Mr. Cheetah, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the term adversarial as used in the Culler decision. Mr. Olson suggested that this certainly was an adversarial proceeding, and that's one of the circumstances identified by the Supreme Court in that decision as, you know, possibly determinative of whether attorney fees could be awarded. Is it necessary first that we find this was not an adversarial proceeding in evaluating whether the district court abused its discretion? And then if you could help me out with what you think the definition of adversarial is as well, that would be helpful.
Oh, certainly, Your Honor. So the second part of the Culler test, which is really kind of independent from that Hansen test about whether there's a title contest, and the court got at that earlier, you know, we don't believe that, you know, being an unfriendly litigant, you know, converts the proceedings in the adversarial context. So this court really doesn't have to make any findings other than look at what the district court decided, that this was not, you know, truly an adversarial proceeding, that being an unfriendly litigant does not convert the proceedings to being adversarial. And especially in a case like this, where you're dealing with real estate, of course, the public policy impact on that, I think, is huge to suggest or to provide authority or precedent that, you know, a party can defeat cost or charges in this partition statute by taking on sort of a scorched earth policy. That's totally antithetical to the way real estate is supposed to be used, right, in this country. Long history that real estate should be used actively and efficiently. And sort of, we believe that appellant's position throughout this case was just completely inconsistent with that. And so that's, of course, sort of a dangerous precedent, that just simply being, you know, delaying proceedings for no legitimate purpose would somehow convert it to being an adversarial proceeding. And Culler really gives us the lesson about this by suggesting or holding that in order for it to be adversarial, you know, we don't have a lot of decisions to really draw from, but Culler is the best one. And how did Culler find that the proceedings were or were not adversarial? Well, it looked at the fact that defense counsel fought in that case to bring the price of the property up, not down as here. They had numerous, you know, conferences and consultations. They sought delay, not just for the sake of delay, but for bona fide business purposes, and obtained funds to drive up plaintiff's ultimate purchase price in the case. So that's a good example. I don't know if I have a beautiful definition of adversarial, but that's the example that we can draw from. And what I would point out is that even in some of the cases cited by appellant, if we look at the out-of-state case in Missouri, the Lyles decision, they did talk about what this court referred to earlier, that the adversarial context, that's really sort of intertwined with whether someone's acting in good faith, right? And they said that the defendant in that case contested in good faith, which was sort of the equivalent of being an adversary proceeding. They noted that plaintiff's attorney worked exclusively on behalf of his own client and against the interests of defendant. What did Ms. Campbell, the respondent here, do to stand in the way of defendant either buying the property or fetching that very large purchase price? Nothing. So there are a lot of red herrings with regard to this issue of adversarial, whether the proceeding was adversarial. But really, in the end, all these things that appellant asserts made it adversarial were simply just, you know, things that drove up costs, attorney's fees, without any particular end game. We talk about the service by publication argument, not appealed, missing money from the estate, dropped on the eve of trial because they were worried about subject matter jurisdiction. Why were they worried about subject matter jurisdiction at the time of trial, but not in August or September of 2019? The court noted that the trial court stated that the issue of personal jurisdiction was not a close call, and that was brought for a delayed. Clearly, we have case law that the issue of personal jurisdiction is waived if not provided in an answer. Nicollet County Public Water, 633 Northwest 2nd, 25. So Judge Castro did not, I think, take kindly to the idea that someone who owned real estate in the county and also took up domicile down the block would challenge personal jurisdiction in a partition action that wouldn't, you know, be going away, as he said. And so one of the other red herrings is that bad faith was somehow required here. I know the appellant's trial court memo referred to, you know, 549.211 bad faith sanctions, but the statute doesn't apply in this case. The statute that applies, of course, is 558.10. But the issue of good faith, bad faith, I think, can be taken into account when we look at whether there was a truly adversarial or whether it was a truly adversarial case. Appellant makes some case out of the fact that he had an emotional attachment to the property. But even if we were to ignore, you know, his dilatory conduct for 2 years prior to litigation, as the court found, but even the year of litigation, all we have to do is look at the bank letter provided at midnight in this case by appellant. It basically said that the bank was telling Mr. Larson that he could come get the money and buy the property. And Mr. Larson, appellant, was testifying, well, he didn't know it was a cash deal. Well, the cash deal was right in his late 11th hour purchase agreement. He didn't know when the closing was. The court had asked him the prior day for a letter about a mortgage, and he rang in this letter about, to me, it looks like he would be paying cash according to the bank. And again, you know, respondent didn't stand in his way. Not Judge Castro didn't stand in his way at that point. He could have deposited that money with the court. Again, judging from the letter, seems to me he could have got a check from the bank. And we don't know why he didn't do that. He just didn't seem to know what was in the purchase agreement. He stated that his intention was to have a mortgage, but clearly the purchase agreement stated it was a cash deal. And so Judge Castro gave him that opportunity. Respondent testified at trial, look, I still want my brother to have the property, but he's got to come to the plate. And so these are just part of those red herrings in terms of that this was some kind of truly adversarial proceeding. But based on the case law that we could pull from, and based on public policy, we don't think it's a good idea to make a scorched earth litigation strategy the equivalent of an adversarial proceeding.
Mr. Chita, I have a question for you. In Kohler, the Supreme Court also focused on whether there was a benefit to all parties, and appellant argues there wasn't a benefit to him because his goal was to retain ownership of the home, to stay in the home, and the home was sold and he was forced out of the home. So did appellant benefit from the partition?
I would say clearly he did benefit. It doesn't say that is a subjective issue for a particular party to decide what's a benefit to them. If Mr. Larson, appellant here, would have been granted a $5,000 award, you know, absent some testimony by him that wouldn't have been a benefit. We would have been arguing that was a benefit and that was a substantial benefit. But we're talking about a property that was a complete windfall. The property basically went from, you know, appellant was guarding it and barricading it, a no income producing property, a vacant home with delinquent taxes, to a financial windfall in the amount of nearly $100,000. Now, whether he decided to spend that money on attorney's fees or otherwise, that's not a concern for the trial court. So it's an objective matter. I'm not sure how we can argue that kind of a financial windfall is not a substantial benefit. And had there been a far reduced distribution to appellant here, we would be making the same argument. But I think Mr. You know, the owner, again, this is abuse of discretion on Judge Castro's determination on that front. And so he found that it was a benefit, a substantial benefit. And we're not sure how that would be reversed on an abuse of discretion standard. I think appellant's going to have to cite some case law that an emotional attachment is a legitimate, that would sort of destroy a financial windfall somehow. And he just doesn't cite anything in that respect. And so there's not any case law that we can see that would render this financial windfall not a benefit to him and not a substantial benefit to him. And so with that, I believe I don't have other comments. We're asking the court clearly to affirm that the trial court in all respects, unless the court has other questions for me.
Thank you. It doesn't appear there are any further questions from the panel. So thank you, Mr. Cheetah. Mr. Olson, you can proceed with your rebuttal when you're ready.
Your Honor, with 5 minutes, I don't have enough time to rebut all of counsel's arguments. I would note that virtually every one of those arguments were raised in respondent's brief, and we did address them in our reply brief. So I would ask this court to take the arguments today into the context of our disagreements in our reply brief. Just some quick issues. The trial court didn't use the terminology substantial benefit to my client. Use the terminology common benefit. Well, that never came up. I'm not sure what windfall my client got in this case or what Ms. Campbell got in this case. They owned the property. There's no windfall involved. That's just, I don't even know what the purpose of the argument is. This claim that somehow my client improperly delayed the proceeding simply isn't borne out by the facts of the case. The scheduling order was complied with. The scheduling order was issued before my client even knew there was a lawsuit in March of 2019. It set deadlines for a pretrial in December of 2019, and it set a trial date for the first week in February 2020. None of those dates were moved. My client didn't ask for a continuance, extension, anything of the sort. So there was no delay in this case, as counsel has argued here. And the fact of the matter is, the respondent didn't show up for the pretrial, which arguably had some effect on how this thing could have gone. We could have potentially resolved it at the pretrial. Respondent and counsel didn't show up. Also referred to a partial award of attorney's fees in this case. I don't know what he's talking about because his client was awarded all the fees she was seeking in this matter. If he's talking about the fact that my client was only required to pay half of those fees, well, that's what the statute says. I don't know what the argument is there. She was awarded all of her fees in conjunction with what the statute allowed. The reason why we submitted an affidavit of attorney's fees was to demonstrate that both parties had substantial attorney's fees in this matter. And a number of the cases cited in our brief, and I think it was the Missouri case in particular, discussed the fact that it's inappropriate to award attorney's fees to one party in a partition action when both parties have incurred substantial fees. Also said that we didn't object to the fee award or the basis for the award. On the contrary, we did both at the district court level, and we also did in our brief by arguing that there was no breakdown of what fees were incurred for what purposes, what fees were incurred for my client's benefit or not for her benefit. One of the findings of fact that I wanted to address that I didn't initially pertains to the submission made by respondent's counsel at the end of this matter, or in the district court level, where they made it clear that the fees were incurred for her benefit, weren't incurred for my client's benefit. Her attorney said all the fees were incurred for her benefit and proper representation. So there was a concession there that the fees were not incurred for my client's benefit. As to this, the issue of the constitutional challenge, again, we did comply with what the court said. We did comply with the rules. What's noteworthy is the respondent didn't even put forth an argument in her responsive brief pertaining to the constitutional challenge. She didn't address separation of powers, didn't address the argument of equal protection violations. They had the opportunity. They didn't take it. I don't know why. One can only assume they might not have had any kind of a basis to do so. I'm not seeing a clock on here. My time getting up.
You have 12 seconds left, Mr. Olson. It's in one of the grids. I'm sorry you're not able to see it. But okay. If you can wrap up shortly, we'd appreciate it.
Again, I would just simply ask the court to take a look at our reply brief with regard to the arguments that were raised by counsel here today. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much to both counsel for your helpful arguments. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe.
Thank you.
Thank you.